So, classes and objects. This is a chapter that is a kind of extension to what you've already seen before, at the very beginning of the semester, which was the stack machine for interpreting procedural programs, like C programs. So you have to recall a little bit the different facilities that we had for translating procedural programs, which was this frame that we had on the stack, where there was something like the local variables and the actual parameters. You could obtain them somehow. There was something like an extreme pointer that keeps track of how large your local variable stack can grow so that you won't hit your heap at some time. There was something like this enter and this mark, and there was slide, and all these funny little instructions that we introduced for translating procedure calls. There was also something which was a way to combine data in a structured way. That was a code generation scheme for structs. So these are the important steps that you need to take consideration to when you extend your machine to also cover something like classes and objects. So let's dive straight into what we're going to do today with a little example of what the source level of what we want to cover will be. So we will be covering something that is a kind of mixture between the Java or C++ style of classes and objects. So what are the components that are important in this? First of all, we will have something like a class introduction and a class body, where we will have data elements called attributes. There's also some a certain kind of attribute here. We will have something like a constructor, which is introduced with the same name as the data type itself had. Then there will be methods of different kinds. There will be methods that are ordinary methods that we had before, which are called static methods in the context of classes. Then there's methods that are associated with a certain object, which are the object methods. And then there's some that are dispatched virtually, and thus are called virtual methods. That is an example that we have here. It's a virtual method. This one is introduced with a virtual keyword. The other ones, well, will be the standard ones without any keyword. That would be the object methods. And then there's the static methods, which have a static before. Okay. And inside these bodies of the of methods, you will have things like references to attributes. There can be calls to certain other methods. There can be, well, it's not done here, but there might be turn up something like this expression. So these are all elements of object orientation that we want to cover in this area. You'll also have something like inheritance, but at least for the moment we will restrict ourselves to single inheritance. So nothing funky, spooky going on. So that is the source level of constructs that we want to cover here. I hope you're familiar with them. If not, you will learn about how to generate code for them anyway. So, the whole thing is a little bit oriented on the C++ syntax, but it's also a little bit mixed with the Java way of doing it, like having only single inheritance. What we want to achieve is that we want to take as much of the infrastructure that we had for procedural code generation for our C machine over to our new object-oriented machine to make as minimal of an effort as possible. And we'll see how we will fare with that. We have the components, like the attributes. We have in our classes something like constructors. There's keywords like virtual that can be attached to member functions. This means that the methods will be dispatched according to the actual type of the object that we will that this will be belonging to. So yeah, there are situations where you can assign an object at some place to an to a variable that is typed with the parent's type, and in this case, even though you call the method on the parent type, then a virtual method will nevertheless jump to the implementation of the child. So that is what the virtual dispatching does. And yeah, there will be static methods which will which are not able to actually see the current instance of the object at all, so it doesn't and also isn't dispatched virtually but statically. That's why they're called static functions. So those won't be too funky at all. They will be just something like our well-known ordinary functions. Okay, something that we won't cover here because that, this belongs for the most times to the static front end of the whole thing will be handling access restrictions like public, protected or private. There can be a few tweaks that you can do to your virtual machine to better support something like this, but yeah, for the most parts this will be something that can be done statically in the code, or at least is done statically. Yeah, and the other thing that we want to ignore is multiple inheritance that will make object layout a lot more complicated. Possibly, when we're fast enough with the current material, we can do a little focus on multiple inheritance tomorrow, if you like so. But yeah, that's something that we're going to vote on at the end of today's session. Okay. So, now to the object layout. You have to keep in mind that we had already some kind of composed data structure that was the structs. And what we did for the structs was that we treated them as continuous blocks of memory, where we had an address environment that told us at which index we would find a certain field of that structure. So that is a similar approach as we will have for our object layout. Once again, we will have some kind of memory area, which we will partition for the attributes. And yeah, what is the things that need to go in an object representation? Well, for once, it will be the attributes, because they will be characterizing one instance of this class that makes a certain object. But also, another thing is that we need to, well, we have seen that there's something like virtual dispatching going on, which means that anyway we will access this object afterwards, we will always be directed to a method body, a method implementation that is actually dependent on the history of the object, how it was created. So this is also a task that can be done by storing the reference to these virtual methods inside of the object. At least that is the simple decision that we have for our model here. In reality, there is a little bit more going on there. There's often things that are called virtual tables that manage the pointers to the methods. But at least for the simple version of inheritance that we have here, we can also do without any virtual table, but just with managing managing slots in our object representations that store the references to the particular methods. So these are all things that need to go in the in the layout for one of these objects. So for the example that we've seen before, we had the attribute information info, which goes into the object representation. What else did we have? There was there was next pointer, which was also an attribute that's also blue and appearing here as being next. And we are done with all the attributes. What's still missing is there was one virtual method specified, which was this last method. And the last method also needs to go in there because it is virtual, and thus the call depends on the object telling the call where to dispatch to. So that's why last is in there. I was a lot of the time now talking about something like inheritance. That means modeling your data is something that you do in a kind of incremental way. For inheritance-based object orientation, what you do is you specify extensions to the data objects or data classes that you had beforehand. And the resulting objects of the resulting class then are able to make use of all the attributes that you have specified for the predecessor of the current class. So you need to come up with an idea to represent that also. What you do is, you can already read it here, so I won't ask for that. You will append stuff to your current object representation. Can you imagine any reason why you do something like appending instead of prepending stuff? So what would that mean in
treating subclass as the superclass?
And what does it have as an effect on the implementation? Why is prepending not so well suited for that?
When you you have a single point you can use for superclass instance and subclass instance.
So that is the actual thing. When you do casting, that's where the whole thing comes into play. You you need to whenever you use your object with a reference that has only a parent type of the whole thing, it will also be able to be used in code generated for objects of your parent type. These code passages will access the fields and the virtual method entries that you have in your base classes layout according to the old layout. If you want to circumvent relayouting your children's object representation in order to fit into the access patterns that you had for the parent, all you need to do is just leave the part that was for your parent object alone and just append to the rest, because the access pattern for the beginning stuff is still the same, and all you need to use for your incremental update is just larger indices that will lead into the part of the object layout that belongs to your child's representation. So that is the whole reason behind that. So, for example, if we do a special implementation of our list, which is this my list thing, this will end up inheriting all the stuff that we had for the ordinary list. This consists in, just generating the part of the object that was your predecessor list, and then what you do is you simply append the update that you specified with your myList class, which means adding just another attribute, more info. And that is this one over here. So that's what is behind all that. You have a principle of reusing as much of the things that you had before. This means that you need to keep the old access patterns in your new data structures whenever you see that they will be used in some old places. So you need to keep the old layout, and you can conveniently extend your object by just appending to the rest. Okay. Together with this certain kind of layouting comes also the need for something that tells you about layout when doing the whole code generation phase. This means that you need to keep track of address environments. That's something that you have already seen when talking about structures. They also had a special address environment for their type. And yeah, what changes when you introduce concepts of object orientation, at least in this approach? Well, global variables and local variables are something that is still inherited from the kind of global address environment. But there's other things, like there's attributes. And an attribute is just specified, well, you mark it as being an attribute, and you what you attach to it is an offset to the beginning of this object's representation. Then there's standard functions, non-virtual functions. Thus, they have an N as a marker. And what is characteristic about them is that they have a static address that you have to jump to. So you can just incorporate that in your address environment. For static functions, it's all the same. You mark it with S as a static function and have a static address. The only thing that that is a little bit difficult here is for virtual functions. And you remember what you had to do is you had to provide virtual dispatching based on the identity of the object. The idea is for the object to carry the addresses of the virtual methods with itself. And how this can be achieved is that you enter in the address environment, not the actual address, because the address environment is something that is static, that is associated with the static type of the object that is accessed. But what you do is you attach the offset inside the object's representation where the actual reference to the called code is stored. So that is what the little B stands for. That is the relative address of the field inside the object where you can find the address. Yes, please? That is the difference between the generation of the method code itself and also on the calling. The static function has no access to the attributes of the object. That means that it doesn't get any pointer to the actual object, while the non-virtual function is a function that is attached to a certain instance of this class, so it needs a pointer to the object. This is only a difference in parameter passing. For one, you need to pass the pointer to the object, and for one, for the static one, you do not need to. And also on the other side, for code generation, you need to manage without. So, yeah. So that is the only difference. So, together with the errors, yes, there was another one.
When talking about passing, when we call, when we have a class that has a virtual function and we have a subclass which overrides the virtual function, mm-hmm. when we then cast the subclass
question for illustrating the effect of this casting. So let's try to make it onto the slides. So you have some parent and a child, and you have a function there and a function there, which is called the same and have the same parameters, none whatsoever. And let's just mark them with red and green to make a difference to get to know from which they are originated. So your situation is that you have a pointer to P, which is kind of filled with a C. Is it? Mm-hmm. So and then you're asking what is happening when we do something like this. So in this case, the idea is that for doing this call, we will see that a little bit later on, but let's have a kind of preview into that. You access this name F. What you do then is you look it up in your address environment, and you will realize that F is something, well, it must have been declared as being a virtual function. If you can see that by checking the marker. From virtual functions, you know that if you want to call them, you have to first dereference from your object. So what you do is you will look into your I have it already. You will kind of load from your P, which is well stored somewhere. You will have to load the address for the P somehow. I don't know where this one will be, and you will also load a constant for the B. You will add them up so that you will navigate to the field where the virtual function's data is stored. Then you will once again load to get the reference to the method, and then you will call. Well, there's no parameters, so I don't have to do anything about that. So that is the process. So what does that do? In the new C, we will create the layout for the object, which will also incorporate filling the slots for the attributes and the virtual methods. This will also mean that in this slot, we will place our red functions reference. So as soon as we dereference this one, this will end up on the stack and will be loaded at that point on the stack, so it can be called here. So it will actually be C's F. For the non-virtual version, you will have an absolute value here, so there's no nothing like this going on, and you won't be able to see which implementation we had in this one. Okay, so that's kind of a preview of what we intend to do in the whole thing. Good. So now when we meet instance of some variable name like this, what is now the code that we will produce for that, the left hand side code? Yeah, and that depends actually on what the whole thing is. In the case that the expression that we generate code for is plain this, we will do load relative to the frame pointer of -3. That seems a little bit arbitrary now, but we will actually come to the point where we explain why it is exactly -3 and why it needs to go to the frame pointer. But for time being, this will be just a fixed pattern for this expression. In case that the X has the type of, what is it, global. Well, in this case, we won't change anything. We will still go to the we'll still load from a certain address. And yeah, then there's the local one. For the locals, we still won't change anything. It's still loading relative to the frame. But now what we have is attributes. How do we translate attributes? Well, you can imagine the translation of that being like the translation of a normalized expression in the sense of translating this dot x, something like this. And what you will get then if you apply the code generation scheme for the structure access, for example, what you get is you get the code L for this part over here, and we've already said that this one will be load relative -3, so there's still the kind of magic. And apart from that, we will just access the delta to the slot where we store the attribute with load CA, and we then couple them with an add. So that is what structural access was all about. And yeah, it all boils down to that we have an implementation for the an access to a current object, and that in our code generation scheme, the pointer to the current object has the relative address -3. So I think we'll soon see what, yeah, well, there's still macro going on, but we'll soon see what all this is about. This is now the macro that we can use for a code R generation of accesses to fields in our objects. And you can imagine this load M being something like load from a member, or store M as store to the member. So M standing for member here. And yeah, it doesn't do anything special than just loading the pointer to the current object, and then adding the delta to the accessed attribute, and then doing either load or store depending on what you call exactly. So that is can be seen as a kind of an another macro. So we don't have to patch anything too fiddly in our virtual machine. Yeah. So the famous current object pointer, that is something that we could have modeled with an extra register, like a whole lot of things that we could have to decide where to put them in the machine. For our simple purposes, we just store it in the frame, as we don't want to mess up the C machine's architecture too much. So we can share implementations with the C machine, and yeah, that's what where the current object pointer goes to. Yeah, this also means that this certain spot in the frame has also needs.